"It is quite cool," said Gandalf. "Take it." Frodo received it on his shrinking palm. It seemed to have become thicker and heavier than ever. "Hold it up," said Gandalf, "and look closely." As Frodo did so, he now saw fine lines, finer than the finest pen strokes, running along the ring, outside and inside. Lines of fire that seemed to form the letters of a flowing script. They shone piercingly bright, and yet remote, as if out of a great depth, the shadow of the past. Today on The Grey Company, we discuss how to benchmark or test the deck. Is it possible to look at a deck and get a sense of whether it is strong or weak? How can you go about putting a deck through the fire to see its true metal? All this and more on episode 41 of The Grey Company Podcast.
It is episode 41 of the Grey Company Podcast. Today's topic is thanks to Charles W., who asked us about benchmarking. Benchmarking involves the questions posed at the top. How can you gauge the effectiveness of a deck accurately? Can it be done on paper or just through play? And if it's done through play, which quests are best for testing things out? It's a great topic, and if you have something you'd like us to discuss on the show, do send it our way. Before we tackle this pressing issue, let's check in with the complete... You heard me. Complete Grey Company. And hear about what's new with the Lord of the Rings, the card game for them. So, Ian, you're a very learned man. How did this happen? How did the four of us get together? Was this some
I think it has something to do with the alignment of the constellations. And
it is a full moon tonight, actually.
That explains it.
There you have it.
Confirmed. Case closed. It is known.
So what's been going on game-wise for you these days, Ian?
Pretty much just all Stormcaller all the time. Mm-hmm. As far as when I get a chance to play, I've just been playing that quest a lot, which is a great quest.
It's a tricky
super
one.
Super thematic, chasing down a boat. You can practically feel the wind blowing through your hair as you're playing. So I've had a lot of fun with that one. And yeah, that's been pretty much it.
Which deck have you been most successful with when you play it?
The ones I've been pretty successful with is my latest Caldara deck, which you can find on RingsDB. plug. It's called I Will Survive if you want to find it.
But she won't.
That's such an irony.
So that one, and I've been experimenting with various new Denethor decks, and there's a Palantir Denethor deck that I made, which is a lot of fun. So I'm a big Palantir supporter these days.
I just have to say on that note that I am such a big fan of ringsdb.com, because I finally, and this will be my little state of the game, I finally come to grips with the fact that I'm just not a very good deck builder. I'm just too hasty, and I don't take time to think things through. I'm a hasty hobbit. So being able to just steal decks from guys like you or Stokes Book or C-Stan or all those other, you know, or all the Decoder guys has been very beneficial to my play. And I feel like it cuts down on setup a lot, too, when I can just find a deck that I like and go for it. So a second plug for ringsdb.com. Matthew, how are you, sir? And what have you been doing with our lovely game?
I am fine. And I actually... got to play the game a little bit this afternoon.
Awesome.
Played Ruins of Belagost. Got ruined. Nice. And played the second quest of the Grey Havens box. So it was my first time playing it. It was pretty easy. There was never a moment where it was even possible for us to win. So it was kind of just plodding along. I like the idea of the double-sided locations. I thought that was cool. The quest itself, though, I wasn't too impressed with. Only because it was so easy and there was never really a tense moment. And maybe we got lucky, I'm not really sure, or our decks just happened to work really well. But it definitely was a cool idea of not knowing what the locations were. I liked that a lot. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I got to play, you know, real cards for the first time in quite a while, and it was fun.
That's great.
Thanks.
And is it true that there's a certain something from your past that might be returning to the YouTubes?
Shadow of the past.
Yeah, the quote was appropriate in many ways. Yeah, Mitch has decided to resurrect from the dead the progression series. We're starting from scratch. There's a whole host of reasons why Mitch decided to do that. You can read about those and some comments on his Facebook pages. But actually, this is like Lord of the Rings Day, so I apologize if I'm a little... my mettle has been tested. I was playing for a couple hours before this episode. Now we're recording, and then Mitch and I record after this.
Oh, brutal.
So I'm, you know, 4 months of Lord of the Rings, I think, crammed into one afternoon. But luckily, I'm off work. I taught this morning, but I'm off for the rest of the day, which hasn't happened in months. So, you know, you got to squeeze it in when you have time. So, yeah. I don't sound excited for it, I don't think, at the moment. But in part because I'm tired and I've been working a lot, and I feel like I can't use today to relax. But I am excited about the return of the progression series. And it's really been humbling, and I don't say that lightly, to see the overwhelming fan response about how many people got into the game because of the progression series. And I think that we were, or at least I can't speak for Mitch, but I was semi-aware of that at the time. But to have, you know, these videos have 40, 50, 60 comments, and not an insignificant amount of them saying, I got into the game because of you, or became better at the game because of what you guys did, or just enjoyed it more deeply and thoroughly. I don't know, it's a nice feeling, and I do think the progression series was a unique and valuable aspect of the community for a while, and I'm glad it's back, and I'm already ready to catch up to current content, but it'll be fun to start back at the beginning, because for a lot of those quests, it's been a very long time since I played them. Probably the last time I played a lot of those early cycles was on the progression series, so it'll be fun to revisit.
No, that'll be great. Yeah, and I can vouch for that as well. I learned how to play watching your guys' videos, so it'll be exciting to see you guys rehash that, and also to see how many more new people it affects. So
yeah,
I'm very excited as well.
Good.
Dan, how are you?
Doing well. I think I'm in the same boat, pun intended, with Ian, where I've just been playing Flight of the Stormcaller a ton, and just add my voice into the chorus. I think that quest is fantastic. I really enjoy the theme. It's fun. It hits the right sweet spot in terms of challenging, but not, you know, it doesn't feel too easy, but it doesn't feel frustratingly hard. So I really like that I can bring lots of different decks to it and take a different approach. Hmm. And I especially like that you can choose to kill the ship, or, you know, just catch up to it.
Yeah, that was the first time I played it. It dawned on me in the second phase that I could just quest out. So I'm like, why am I trying to take down this gigantic ship when I can just hoist the sails and break for it?
But I'm sure
it is very satisfying to take that ship down.
Well, it's fun, too, like the replay value-wise, right? Because like the first time we played it, we caught up to it, and then you want to play it immediately again and be like, let me bring like the crazy all-combat deck and just try and destroy it. And there's nothing quite as ridiculous as having like Aragorn and Treebeard, you know, just beat the crap out of a giant ship.
Treebeard's like sobbing, saying, I'm sorry, as he's like smashing the wall.
Many of these planks were my friends.
Yeah, I love quests that have like those kind of multiple endings or like ways to beat it. So I did the same thing where I was beating that quest first just by catching it, and then I was like, I need to take down that ship. And so the last game I played, I finally did that with a Caldera deck and a Denethor deck, and it basically was like, because the Stormcaller kind of chokes your damage, so it was over like 5 or 6 rounds. Each deck was tanking like 3 to 4 enemies each, because I was just putting all my attention and trying to put damage.
Which
on
ships
that thing,
did you choose? Which was your preferred ship?
I pretty much usually always pick, well, you have to pick the Dream Chaser, and then Naralenya, I think it's called.
The one that gives your heroes +1. Attack.
No, it's reduce the cost of the first ally.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the most ridiculous ship in an Int deck, I have to say. I had so many Ints in play when I was running that ship. It was absurd.
And then sometimes I'll take the... if the deck is moderate or low threat, I'll take the raise your threat by 3, and then you get an extra card a turn, which
can't nice too.
Turn your nose up at that one either. Mm-mm.
Well, we could talk about boats all day, but our topic for the evening is benchmarking. And again, to recap, benchmarking is just that, figuring out how effective your deck is. And there are various ways to do that, and we're going to go through a few of our own ideas. And I'm sure all of you have your own ideas as well. So make sure that you comment on our blog or get involved on social media to hear how you benchmark your decks. But to start, we're going to talk about the eyeball test. So I'll just pose the question to everyone. Is it possible to just look at a deck list and see if it is strong or weak? What do we think about that?
I definitely think it is. Okay. There are certain cards that I think are probably even in need of errata, but I'll give a for instance. I mean, if I see a deck with Tactics Boromir that includes Gondorian Fire, Blood of Numenor, and any kind of resource generation, it's going to be strong.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you see Spirit Pippin, and adding to that, I think there's certain things I'll look for, like the two things are kind of resources and card draw. Like, is this, you can look at a deck list and say, is there enough card draw on this or any card draw at all? Are they going to be able to pay for stuff? Those are the kind of things I think you can eyeball. Some things are a little harder to just figure it out by looking at them.
Because this kind of goes back to the episode we did on the one deck. And if you're going to have the one deck, it's got to be able to do X, Y, and Z. It's got to have resources and card draw and attack and defense and all these things. But I don't know, how easy is it to gauge, even if a deck has the cards to do those things, how effectively it can do them? You know, so in other words, are there enough cards to generate resources that you're actually going to see them? Or is there enough card draw to get to those resource cards? And is there enough willpower depending on the quest that you're doing? So I guess, you know, like to speak to Dan's point, when you've got the makings of a power deck, you can say that it's probably going to be pretty good, but I guess you need to be a little more critical in the way you look at it or actually put it on the table to find out just how good it is. Is that accurate?
I think so. Although with any card game of this nature, there's a big luck component. And what I specifically mean is, what are the top 10, 20 cards of your deck? You know, an average game is going to last 5, 10, 15 rounds. And so you may only draw the top 10 or 15. Unless, you know, of course, there's extra card draw. So like today, you know, I played 3 games, 2 Ruins of Belagost and 1, whatever the second quest in Grey Havens is. Second quest of Grey Havens, man, I hit all the money cards early on. I just had a swarm of Rohan dudes. I had so many resources I couldn't keep up with spending. I was Elven Lighting every turn. So, you know, an abundance of riches. And then we get to Ruin of Belagost, where I really needed my previous board state and just was not hitting my money card. Just like, oh, great, another freaking Snowborn Scout. That's really going to help against this stupid-ass troll. So, I drew my third copy of Calabrian Stone, which normally I'm lucky if I see one of them. So I think a big part of not being able to benchmark a deck very well is simply the random component of a CCG or LCG, meaning every card in the deck could be solid, and if you draw them in the right order and at the right time with the resources to pay for it, the deck's going to sing. But if you don't and things get clumped at the bottom or in the middle, then a great deck can be rendered near useless. And so I think you can eyeball a deck, yes, and say that in general, if things go well, this deck is going to perform adequately. But really, and I think in many ways, as a total aside, that this episode is part and parcel of our deck building series. It's what I keep thinking with all the comments we've already made. I'm sure it'll be in the back of my head going forward. But a good deck builder can sort of, at least as much as possible, try to plan for all the things I'm talking about, right? So if X doesn't go my way, like if I don't get that one linchpin or two linchpin cards that I need, do I have anything else in my deck to sort of deal with that? And I think that's where a lot of people don't get past the Steward of Gondor or the whatever else. They just depend on drawing that one thing or two things. And if it doesn't happen, the whole deck comes crumbling down, whereas a better deck can have answers to answers, right? Plans within plans. Yeah. So long-winded answer there, but yes, tentatively.
It's really important what you're talking about, because like luck is a huge part of the game. Luck not only in what your deck draws, but then also in what the encounter deck draws. You can get games where the encounter deck just combos early on and you have no hope. And the one thing that I would say that you can help to mitigate that is there are certain heroes where you're going to know that no matter what your opening hand is, you have some kind of option. Two good examples of recent heroes that give you that is Arwen, where it doesn't matter, even if after the second mulligan I have a crap hand, I can ditch that, you know, maybe that second Calabrian stone to at least get the extra resource bump turn one to at least try and put something down to survive, right? And same thing with the new Denethor. That's why I think that hero is so amazing, is starting with three resources on one hero. As long as you have some leadership cards in your deck, even if you don't see that steward, you can, you know, you can get like a first turn ally Faramir, or a first turn sword that was broken, or, you know, just something to get you to get yourself going to kind of survive the early game, even with a bad mulliganed hand.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess I would, what I would say kind of about the eyeball test is that if kind of the tricky part is that the more experience you have, the more able you're going to be able to look at a deck and tell whether it's strong or weak, because you have your own experience to draw upon. Yeah. And so maybe that's not as helpful for a new player who might be kind of asking this question about, can I look at a deck on RingsDB and figure out whether this is one that I should tell? And the answer to that, if you're a newer player, is probably no. Like, honestly, because you won't have the experience, more than likely. But in order to build that experience, I think you try out a variety of decks, and some of them, I think there's value to be had in trying out a deck that's not that good, because then you'll be able to figure out why it's not that good when you're getting pasted by some orcs, because you're not being able to pay for anything.
Yeah,
and by contrast, if you try out a good deck, then you'll be able to see what it's like to have it, you know, running in practice.
Definitely. And that's something I mentioned on an early episode in the show, was a hard lesson I had to learn, was that, like, it's okay to lose. It's okay to suck. Even though this is a single player, you know, and a lot of times I play solo, but even though it's a single player or cooperative game, you know, you expect to come out on top, or there's no consequence for fudging it if you just really want to get past this particular quest. But there's something to be said for experience, and there's no way to learn this thing, especially the eyeball test, without just getting your hands dirty and trying stuff out.
Yeah, I think with any card game, how do I want to articulate this without sounding sort of like an asswipe? But every card game has cards that look so freaking cool, and then they cost 500 resources. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh my god, I want to get this big beefy dude, whether it's green creature in Magic that's super huge and super awesome, or whether it's some big beefy ally in this game, or some event that gives you plus 100 willpower and a million resources. You really want to play it, and then in reality, you realize, oh, this isn't so hard to pull off.
Right.
Or, like the new Aowyn we talked about last week. Oh, it looks so flashy, it's super cool, I can hit for 9. Oh, that really doesn't mean much when the enemy has 25 hit points and Ruins of Belagost. You know, and so I think the difficulties of not having experience is you really want to play the big, flashy, unique cards. And oftentimes they're just sort of there to be flashy, and if you want a consistent, well-tuned deck that can handle most things that come its way, not all, but most, a lot of times those big flashy cards don't make the cut, because those are so situational or so niche or just too expensive. Your hand's going to get clogged with these things that you can't pay for, and you're not advancing your board state. So I think that a big part of experience is just learning that, yeah, this card would be so awesome if this, and this all went off and went well, and the encounter deck does nothing to me to muck up those plans at all. And you kind of just learn you got to weed those cards out, or at the very least, don't make them a 3 of, you know, throw in 1 or 2 for those really cool moments. But other than that, don't ever expect to see it in a game.
Right.
And one other thing that I would add to that is that sideboards are useful, right? Because, like, some quests have conditions that'll totally lock down your uber hero. And even if it is Boromir loaded up with all the cool gear and he's going to, you know, defend for 1 million and attack for 1 million, if he's got an attachment that keeps him from readying, for example, well, then that completely shuts down that whole strategy. So that's where suddenly a card like Power of Orthanc that is useless in some scenarios becomes like the MVP card, and that, and having that in mind, it's like, it's easy to talk about the eyeball test in a general sense, but some part of the eyeball test is recognizing, again, through experience, that certain cards that would be useless in some quests are amazing in others.
Which brings us to kind of our next step in benchmarking a deck, which are the questions that need to be asked. And one of those questions is, what quests, are good for the kind of deck that I'm building, or the deck in question. And I think we all know that, you know, each quest has a particular theme. And a lot of times these days, the quests require you to do everything. But there are some quests that focus on combat, some that focus on location control, so on and so forth. So what are some quests that you should try for particular kinds of decks? So like I mentioned, combat quests. So what would be maybe like one of the primo combat quests that you would benchmark, you know, a tactics or other kind of combat deck on?
I mean, Into Ithilien is the one that immediately comes to mind for me. If you think you have a good combat deck and it can't handle the first couple rounds of Into Ithilien, then you probably don't have a very good combat deck.
What's the last one of that cycle where it's you got to kill the boss to move on?
That's another good one.
That's maybe a decent one. I guess before deciding on what quest you should test on, though, you have to sort of ask, what's the purpose of my deck? Mm-hmm. And then that turns into something we don't necessarily need to spiral into, but that is this a solo deck, which is an entirely different metric than a multiplayer deck. And I probably said this on other shows, so I'll keep this thought short, but I think it's easier to build for multiplayer than it is for solo.
Definitely.
Because multiplayer, I am the combat deck, or I am the questing deck, and you just throw in cards that, if you're the questing deck, help you quest. And if they don't help you quest, they don't go in. And same with combat, right? If I'm building a combat deck, not using tactics Eowyn, right? I'm using other stuff that can more consistently attack for, you know, more than one attack strength around or something. So, I don't know. In that sense, it's easier, and we might get into this a bit more later, so I'll just keep this brief, but I don't know if you need to benchmark for multiplayer as much. To me, benchmarking really is more in the realm of solo gameplay. But the problem, I think, with benchmarking a deck is the encounter deck isn't always consistent. And so just because your deck works testing it once doesn't mean it's going to work times 2, 3, 4, and 5. Because the order of the encounter cards might be different. And then it sort of just makes me wonder, is it worth benchmarking a deck at all? Which is maybe something we can talk about later, and I think we probably should. But just to float that idea, I'm not even sure I buy the whole premise of this show, which is, should you even bother benchmarking? But I think that's probably the question best say for the end.
So you mentioned Morgul Vale, though, Matthew, and I think that's a great example where that I think that is a great benchmarking quest because it is very consistent. You know that round one you're dealing with Mugash. You know that round two you're dealing with Spoiler Alert. Or what is it? Yeah, and then the third one is the Minas Tirith.
It's not Nazgul Mugash, but whatever. We have the three bosses you got to go through.
It's the traitor is the second round. But the point is that scenario is very consistent. So if you have a deck that you want to fulfill a heavy combat role, you can play through Morgul Vale 2-3 times, and you know you get a pretty good idea of whether or not your deck can handle heavy combat. I would say.
Yeah, I think the consistency issue is key, like you brought up, Matthew, and like you said, Dan, if you really want to benchmark a deck against a quest, you kind of have to play it 2 or 3 times at least. I did an article up on Tales from the Cards a while ago about testing a deck where I proposed like a regimen of like 4 different quests, I think, playing them each 3 times. And the idea was you can't really test the deck against just one quest because there's so many different types of quests, and then within each quest you have to test the consistency of both the encounter deck and your own deck. But before going through all that, I would go back to something Matthew said, which is why are you testing in the first place? Mm-hmm. I think you have to be clear on that before you decide how you're going to test. So if you want the one deck to rule them all, for whatever reason, because it's fun for you, because you just want to, then maybe you do need to do that exhaustive a testing regimen, because that's the only way you're really going to be able to find that out. But if you just want a deck because you want to show up at a pickup multiplayer game and you don't want to be embarrassed because you're not pulling your weight because you have some crappy deck, then yeah, maybe benchmarking is appropriate in that case because you want to give it a quick test run before you show up and everyone laughs at you and Matthew talks crap about you on the next Great Company episode.
Yeah. Pulling your weight.
In that case, the testing is like completely different. So,
sure.
Yeah, it depends.
But pulling your weight in multiplayer can mean so many different things. So, for example, the last time I played the Grey Havens, it was when it came out, probably the same week. And I showed it to the game shop, and I realized, ah, crap, my Rohan deck, which I like to play a lot, wasn't in my deck box. Who knows where it was. Didn't have it with me. So I borrowed a buddy's deck, or maybe I even used that Three Hunters deck you made for me, Ian. I can't remember. I might have used that deck. The deck is good, but it wasn't good for the first quest of Grey Havens, and so I wasn't not pulling my weight because my deck was bad, to use a double negative. I was not pulling my weight because a tactics deck was not appropriate for a quest that ended up playing it blind, never having played the Grey Havens, being a willpower quest, because that's what that first quest is really all about. So it's just so much more different in multiplayer. Now, certainly there can be bad decks in multiplayer that really drag people down, or there can be good decks that people don't play well that really drag the group down. But in general, you know, I think if you know the role you should be playing and you're not picking quests that ignore that role, then it's less necessary to benchmark in a multiplayer game. But the appeal and the listener who wrote us the email to talk about this was like, how do I make sure I'm not wasting my time and everyone else's time by showing up with a really crappy deck? But again, I think that's so dependent. Well, what is everybody else bringing? If you bring the same deck as them, then that's a waste. You know what I mean? Like, it's there's so many other factors that could potentially be outside of your control. Or you just randomly pick up a quest, playing it blind because it's the newest AP to drop, and then your deck sucks, not because it's not good, not because you didn't benchmark it, because no tactics is necessary or no willpower is necessary or something, you know? So again, I'm not saying that it's not necessary, but I think in many ways it could be futile and just as much a waste of time as just learning the good mechanics of deck building, as opposed to having to test. For full disclosure, I've never tested a deck ever. I build a deck. They're usually pretty good and I play. So I don't test decks. I don't have time for that, quite frankly. If I'm going to play, I want to play. And then if I'm playing it and I realize, oh, you know, this didn't work all that well, let me sub in one or two cards. Or a new card comes out in the new AP and I sub it's superior in some way, so I sub it in and, you know, take out something that maybe wasn't as good but was there for thematic reasons or fill in the blank. But I don't really do deck testing in the traditional sense of let me try it two or three times before I go to the game shop. The game shop is my time to refine my deck, and I usually have a sideboard, though, as Dan said, with me, where I can sub things in and out fairly quickly if the demand the need arises.
It is kind of weird, the idea of testing a deck in a cooperative game, because obviously in a competitive game people test like crazy. If you're a Game of Thrones player, you're probably testing it over and over with your people in your meta, trying to prepare for a tournament. And then, leaving aside multiplayer for a second, like, why the heck are you benchmarking a solo deck, right? You're going to play your deck against whatever you're going to play. I think a lot of times why people bring up benchmarking, at least for solo decks in this game, at least I know why I did originally, is because that was kind of the litmus test of me sharing a deck. Like, I didn't want to share a deck with a community that was crap. And so benchmarking for me, and I think for a lot of people as far as solo decks are concerned, is like, is this worth sharing? Like, what quest can I play this against to kind of test? Obviously, I can't play all 50 or 60 or however many, but I can play kind of a sampling just to see, will it hold up against more than one quest?
And I think what you're talking about, Matthew, kind of goes back to the eyeball test. You know, you have a vague idea of what you quest you're probably going to play or your role in the group. You've been playing long enough to have an idea about what's going to work, and that all kind of goes back to experience. And so if you're really that concerned about performing well or making sure your deck doesn't suck, then benchmarking is important. But if you've been playing long enough, then you have an idea about what's going to work and what isn't, and then, as you said, the rest can kind of play out on the table, which is totally fine. And Ian, you mentioned the word meta with Game of Thrones. This benchmarking, or the way you build your deck, also goes down to your local meta or your online meta. If you play with a group that maybe has a set time limit, or they just get to the table and they're down to business, then you should be prepared. But if you have a more leisurely group, a more laid-back group, then yeah, you can have a sideboard and swap out cards depending on the quest you're doing or depending on how your deck performs. And also, I don't, like Matthew said, I don't like testing decks because I want to play. And so I think because we have wonderful people in our community like Ian and Dan and everybody else who contributes to the meta and to the deck building community, you got plenty of people you can rip off who have taken the time to actually benchmark their decks. So if you're listening to this episode and you're thinking, damn it, that really sounds like a lot of work, do what I do and hit up RingsDB or the various blogs and, you know, enjoy the hard work that somebody who enjoys building decks have already put in. I did an article for Master of Lore this week, and we usually do a deck list or something to showcase how the card works mechanically. And I said, you know what? I got nothing for the new Denethor. Stokes Book made an awesome deck that utilizes, that's both thematic and mechanically appropriate. And I put it up there. So benchmarking is great, and we're going to keep talking about it, but if you're tuning out right now, just go find a deck that you like on RingsDB and get back to playing. But for those of us who do want to benchmark, let's go back to quests to test by, if we may. So we talked about Into Ithilien for aggro decks, Morgul Veil for aggro decks. What about if you are working on a location control deck or like a quest heavy deck? What quests do you guys enjoy testing those decks against?
The most exciting quest in the game, Hills of Emmon Wheel.
Is that a good
don't
benchmark?
Don't do that.
Though?
No, it is not a good benchmark.
Well, honestly, I'm semi serious. I haven't played the quest probably since the progression series episode, however many years ago now for that one, but it's at least a crap ton of locations and questing and very few enemies. So it might not be horrible because you don't have to worry about doing much else. So you can sort of see, can I take care of locations or am I really just getting mired down? But as far as fun doing it, maybe not.
Right, yeah. Do you want to enjoy it?
It's a whole
it
different
just...
thing. The two that pop into my head are Steward's Fear, which you might not think of with location control, but locations are often how you die in that quest.
Yeah.
There's a lot. And the Old Forest, very location heavy for sure. And more enjoyable than Emmon Mule, I would say.
I miss Steward's Fear. I'm going to go back and try that one.
It's a fun quest. I would add the Fate of Numenor, which is the one Matthew was mentioning, the second one from Grey Havens, where I agree that it's not necessarily the most difficult, but there is an element where being able to put progress on locations in the staging area allows you to peek at them, which allows you to set some kind of a strategy about where you're going to travel.
That's
and so
point.
Locations definitely are a pretty integral component of that, but not in a way like Hills of Emmon Mule, where I just kind of roll my eyes and go, oh boy, here we go.
I think the sailing quests are pretty good too, because they let you peek at cards, but also it adds another layer of difficulty in that you have to ration out your questing or, you know, your exhausted characters for the sailing test. And so that kind of adds another wrinkle to further test how effectively your deck can deal with the many locations that Middle-earth throws at us.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The other thing I would say briefly, not just on location control, but on testing in general, is that if you are someone who wants to experiment with testing, you don't need to play a whole game, especially if you are thinking to yourself, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for Ian's crazy 12 game regimen. You seriously, honestly, the way this game is structured, most of the time you only need to play maybe the first two or three rounds of a game to get a sense of how a deck functions. In fact, even further, you don't even need to set up a quest sometimes. Just set up your deck, draw some hands, and see how often you can get a good setup going, even without the encounter deck there. And that will give you a sense of, like, am I able to play cards quickly enough, get things going quickly enough that this is going to give me a chance against most decks? Because most quests, you know, it's all about that first few rounds setup.
Tempo. No, that is a great point, because even if you're not drawing many allies or your mana curve for your allies is off, then you, like you said, you can pull that, you can discover that without even having to play a game. That's good.
Yeah, so if you don't want to play the whole Emmon Mule, you can just play the first two rounds. First two or three rounds.
On the flip side, to not, you know, just playing one or two rounds, what about score? And I know most of the community sort of derides the idea that there's even scoring in this game, but could score somehow be a measure by which you benchmark your deck. And to answer my own question, I think what you would need is, well, what's an average score for this quest? And then am I beating the average? And that then would be a lot of work. And since I don't know how actively the quest log is used, I've never used it because I don't care about score. I suppose if you could compare your deck's performance in solo against other solo players playing that quest, and if you're consistently beating the average score, that might be an indication that it's a decent deck. But what do you guys think? Would score be a decent benchmarker?
I think it depends on the quest, because there are some quests, like I want to say Trouble in Tharbad, that like, because it's kind of a, it's very different the way that quest works in terms of getting you down to zero, and then I want to say the later rounds of that you are going back up again, but it makes the score, there would be a lot of noise in that for certain quests, I guess is what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. And so I think that would be a less useful metric, whereas other scenarios that are less unorthodox, it probably would be a good way to measure it. But like, as you pointed out, Matthew, it really depends on if enough people are doing it to actually have a good sample size to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big problem I have with scoring is the metric is because the biggest chunk of the score is how many rounds, like that's 10 points each. So it basically hits control decks really hard that are, you might have a control deck that takes like a billion rounds to beat a game, but it beats that quest like so comprehensively because it just builds up some huge swarm and just trounces it. But then according to the score, it looks like it's so much worse than some other deck that goes through it more quickly, but maybe its victory was kind of on the edge. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's completely worthless as a measure, but it's, I don't know. It's a tough one.
To me, the score and the race against the shadow mode, they're almost like just variant modes of play. I don't know that they're, as Dan said, they can be perhaps in the right context, but for my money, they're more like alternative ways to play, almost like nightmare mode or campaign mode, you know, where it's going to affect how you've address your deck building and your questing because you're playing this particular way. So I don't know. That might be a good one to pose on the socials and see if anybody has tried that. That's a good question.
It's kind of a catch-22 because it takes enough people's playing with score to get a big enough sample size to make it so that playing with score is worthwhile.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Let's give out a few more examples for those who are looking to test particular kinds of quests before we start talking about cooperative games. You know, some other quests that have very particular effects that you might be interested in testing your deck against would be things like direct damage. So if you are designing a deck with that in mind, the Weather Hills are a great option, as are Across the Ettenmoors. And one of my favorites is the enemy swarm. So if you want to deal with an enemy swarm, what would be some of the quests that you might test your deck against?
You know, I keep answering your questions by talking about something completely different, but my mind is sort of racing.
Here, man.
I know. In that, so you know, there's so many wrinkles to benchmarking, which is why I think it's a very difficult topic to talk about. Your card pool is an obvious hindrance to what you're going to do. And I don't even mean, do you have the quests available? But really what I mean is your player card pool. Mm-hmm. So is Weather Hills or Across the Entmoors good to benchmark your deck if you only have the core, Shadow of Mirkwood, maybe, and then randomly you picked up Across the Entmoors? Probably not. You know what I mean? And so, you know, Journey Along the Anduin has the early life of the game was the king of testing decks because everyone thought it was the well-rounded quest. But if I'm trying to test a modern deck, I pretty much feel like I'm going to stomp Journey Along the Anduin just with the first ally I drop because modern allies are so much better than allies in the past. And I know I'm being a little bit hyperbolic here, but I almost wonder if, you know, if you have a very limited card pool, obviously your testing needs to be, it can only be determined by the quest you happen to own. But I wonder, so many of the old quests are so neutered by the current card pool that you kind of have to take that into consideration too. And so, you know, Enemy Swarm, a lot of the Khazad Dooms where those goblins just seem to replicate left and right, but on the flip side, they're so easy to kill with all the direct damage and the traps and all the range shenanigans with the Sylvan and stuff, like Rumil and all those sorts of things, which would be direct damage. But I don't know. In some ways, it's maybe they're good benchmarks. On the flip side, they might just be rendered almost not even worth the setup you did because the quests are just easy because they're so old, and the card game has evolved well beyond what you know we had at the time.
If only there was like a YouTube series that put the quests in context.
Well, I mean, but even still, the progression series isn't going to help you know, you know, what should I test my deck against, you know. So I'm sort of hesitant.
You guys do the testing for us.
Well, that's true. But again, it's with the card pool at the time. So if you want to test anything that's modern, it's going to take us a hell of a long time to get there and help you out. But even still, now that we have a modern card pool, there's so many different options. We were talking, my buddy Steve and I were talking today about the Gen Con quest and how it's big teams of stuff. And, well, now I lost my point of why I was bringing that up. But I had a point that had to do with benchmarking and modern quests and these sorts of things, but the thought has left my head. But we were talking about house ruling it and not letting there be any hero duplications whatsoever in the entire team of 12 players, because we think that would be really fun and that would be an awesome fellowship event.
Yeah.
Where that way, at the fellowship event, everyone's playing together. It's not teams of fellowships because you can only have 4 players. But that was what we were talking about. But I had a thought that I thought was quite profound to do with benchmarking, and I don't remember. So be that as it may, I think, my thought was that because we have so many deck building options now that you could do a game like that where all 12 people are playing something totally different and we have heroes. But way back in the day, there was no benchmarking your deck because you had 10 cards to choose from for each sphere.
Right,
you know what
right,
I mean?
Right,
and so it kind of, you just threw in whatever you had. So much of it, I think, is dependent on the types of quests you tend to play. For me, it's modern quests. I don't really play the old ones anymore. If you're only playing Nightmare, if you're playing Saga, I don't know. There's so many wrinkles that I think make this such a difficult topic that I don't want to say that it renders it useless, but lots and lots of things to consider when trying to determine what you should be doing.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, I think that's why it all goes back to you being very clear about what you're testing for before you test. So if you have a more limited card pool and you're testing because you want to see if you can construct a deck with the cards you have to take on more modern quests, because you're like, I want to buy the Cray Havens and play those quests. So you're probably going to be trying to benchmark your deck against more modern quests and see if the cards you have available are enough. And you either see, yeah, I'm able to take on some of the quests that are happening later on, and in which case I'm good, or I don't have enough. Any deck that I make with the cards I have is just failing, so I obviously need to expand my card pool. On the other hand, if you're testing a deck because you're running your own little progression series with the cards you have, then I think that's a different set of tests that you're doing. And you're probably not going to be benchmarking against the later quests, the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 cycles. You're probably going to be benchmarking against Into the Pit rather than something like Deadman's Dyke. You know, you're probably going to be benchmarking for location against Hills of Emin Mule versus, I don't know, Steward's Fear, like I suggested, or one of the Grey Havens quests. It is tricky, like you said, Matthew, because there's not really like clear guidelines for that. I know that because, you know, I have experience with the game and whatnot, but a newer player might, I think someone who's enterprising could maybe create like tiers of testing quests. Like, right. here's the location control tier. Here's the tier 1 quest that you can benchmark, which is Hills of Illman Mule. Here's tier 2.
Right.
But you know, that doesn't exist right now.
For me, and maybe I'm spoiling my end of show thoughts, but the more we discuss this, because I didn't really prepare notes in my head, I kind of wanted my thoughts to be a little bit more organic today, because I don't benchmark and I really couldn't have thought of anything worthwhile anyway, which is probably a typical episode for me. But I sort of think if you want to benchmark, just play the game. And play the game with buddies that aren't dicks and they're not alpha gamers. Meaning, if your deck isn't holding the weight, they're not going to yell at you. They're not going to be mad at you, and they might give you some good deck building advice or just playing advice. Maybe you got a great hand of stuff, but you didn't recognize a combo that you had that would have been great. I've played with plenty of people over the years leading my local play group that have either crappy decks or they didn't make the best plays, and they really held the group back. But I've never once yelled at them, and I've tried to be helpful and not be alpha gamer and just give minor comments. And I like when people give me comments on my decks. I think that's how you benchmark. You get a good gaming group. you play with people who are not dicks, to use Will Wheaton's rule, you know, just be nice and play the game, right? And so that's one of the reasons the older I get, we've said this on the show countless times, the older I get, the more I only want to play co-op games because I'm tired of competitive stuff where people are jerks, they're not good sportsmen, and those sorts of things. And I think it really, again, decreases the need for benchmarking, because you can just play the game. If the deck doesn't work, bust out another deck, play the quest again. If your new deck doesn't work, well, then you go back to the drawing board and you see what you have to do. But, you know, to spend hours analyzing and get analysis paralysis because you don't want to, you know, make a fool out of yourself at the game shop, I think that's part of the fun.
Definitely. Speaking of which, let's go ahead and talk about benchmarking in these cooperative games. And I don't know, we really have kind of addressed this, because one of the things that you need to think about if you are doing it is it even worthwhile in a cooperative game to benchmark a deck? And just as Matthew said, as long as you have a good group, as long as you have a laid-back group that's not that is obeying Wheaton's law, then you probably don't. But what do you guys think? What might be a good circumstances under which you should benchmark before you head to your local gaming group, if you can think of any?
I don't know if it's benchmarking so much as just what Dan said earlier, and that is having a sideboard in case uniques are doubled and you guys want to follow the uniqueness rule. Mm-hmm. And that way, you know, your deck isn't hampered if you lose one or two unique cards that perhaps you were depending on. You have an answer for that. I think that's the best thing you can do when playing multiplayer, especially if it's a pickup game, which I don't know how often that happens. But if it is, you know, have a sideboard, but also bring two or three decks with you. So that way, hell, bring four, make a questing, a combat, and then two other support kind of decks. And if everyone else is playing something, you have the right deck to fit in. And I know making three or four decks is probably a lot. I really only ever have two built at any given time. But show up with two different options. I usually have my questing Rohan deck and some sort of tactics deck. That way I can sub in whatever is necessary either for the quest or to address the deficiencies of the group that I'm playing with.
That's good.
Yeah, I always have multiple decks built for the Austin, you know, our multiplayer group in Austin, and the uniqueness rule is a big part of it. You know, as you go into a quest and you think, oh, I've got the perfect deck for this, and then it turns out someone else is using the hero that's the linchpin of your perfect deck, and so you have to, rather than try and salvage that, which a lot of times won't work when it's a particular hero, you know, an Elrond Vilya deck without Elrond is not really going to work, so having you know, some fallback decks is good.
Yeah, I think the key, and maybe this isn't so much about testing, because maybe you just want to do like Matthew said, and instead of testing, you're just playing the game. But whatever the case may be, I think beyond benchmarking, it's the idea of, and this goes back to what we talked about in the episode. I don't remember exactly what we titled it, but when we were talking about getting better at the game, which was this idea of, are you asking the right questions after a game to tweak your deck? Because one of the ways that testing is useful is if you are just kind of in this like process of deck building where you're going through iterations. Like I built the first you know, draft, and then I tested it, and then it's something going wrong. And so you're playing the game, whether you're doing conscious testing or just you know, playing whatever quest you feel like at the moment. But you're using that as a tool to kind of keep making these tweaks to your deck. So you're going through like 2.0 of the deck, 3.0 of the deck.
Yeah.
And I think in that case, whether you want to call it testing or not, there's something that you're doing that's useful. But more so even than picking the right quest or whatever it may be, it's are you able to ask those right questions? When I wrote the deck testing series, kind of a lot of the comments I got from newer players was like, I don't get what you're talking about, like asking the right questions. Because it's a hard thing to convey.
Why do I,
like,
suck, bro? That's the question. That's
why
a whole
am I playing with these jerks
for? Yeah.
But you know, at the heart of it, it's really coming down to why did I lose? Why did this deck not do what I needed it to do? Is it because all my heroes got destroyed? Is it because I threaded out? Is it because I just ran out of cards in my hand and I was just top decking Brock Iron Fist every turn? Like, what exactly is causing you to lose? And so I think that's really at the heart of it.
True.
Yeah, totally. I think the biggest difference between competitive and cooperative is we don't have prizes to win. We don't have trophies to win. At least I don't print trophies for every participant in my local play group. Maybe some of the millennials do, but I don't. And so since there, you cannot make a living playing this game like you could perhaps playing Magic or, you know, any, some of the other kind of deck building games where there are cash prizes involved or just, you know, esteem, you know, of the community. It really takes the pressure valve and releases it because we don't have to have good decks. And if you're playing with people who are nice and, as I said earlier, and following Wheaton's rule, then it's much less necessary. Now, certainly if you bring a deck and you can clearly tell that it's not holding its weight, for the most part, we have a fairly friendly community. So post the deck somewhere. Board Game Geek, post it on our Facebook page, COTR's Facebook page, RingsDB. People will give you comments. Mm-hmm. And they'll try to make it better. But you'll also, again, as Ian said, need to ask the right questions. So if you're going to post a deck and want feedback on it, ask or, you know, let the comment, you know, the potential commenters know, well, what didn't go well? Why did the game go south? What did you experience? Because, again, sometimes eyeballing a deck, it's hard to tell. The other thing I think is part of asking the right questions is both pre and post. So post, we've kind of just talked about that. But pre, it's going back to an earlier comment I had, which is why are you putting every single card, all 50 cards, certainly all, you know, the, however many unique cards there are, meaning individual titles, not unique as in, you know, the unique symbol. But why is card A, card B, card C, card D, all the way down the line, being put in your deck? Is it because it's cool and flashy and you like the art? Or is it because it's serving a particular purpose in your deck that needs to be served? And I think that's also a really important question, too. And with a smaller card pool, sometimes you're just putting it in because you need to 50 a tactics card and it's the only one you have left. If you've got the full card pool, then you have a whole host of options. So one of the things that I do when I'm deck building is I lay out all the cards that I want to put in a deck. And those that don't make the cut become my sideboard in a sense. I'm like, okay, well, here's what I thought I was going to want in the deck. Was that the right choice? And then I sort of play around with subbing in certain things. And if I realize a card that I always draw is dead on arrival, then I take it out. So a great example for today is I was playing a quest, Ruins of Belagos, and we just kept getting stomped by enemies. I was like, this is ridiculous. I subbed in the card Helm, which if you don't remember it, you do it after you've resolved enemy attacks. You can exhaust, discard a Rohan ally. You control to choose and discard a non-unique enemy because we were struggling with enemies. That might not be a card I need all the time, and it might be a card that if I'm constantly drawing and it's dead on arrival, I'm going to take it out. But the deck had a particular weakness for this quest that I wasn't quite able to address. So I took out something else that I kept drawing and basically didn't need in my hand and would be annoyed when I drew it and put that in instead. And so to me, that's the real benchmarking. That's the real testing. It's just making minor additions between plays, between play sessions, and seeing how they go. And again, so much is quest dependent that I don't know if Helm is always going to be in my deck, but it certainly could help in a good number of quests.
And I think a lot of what we're talking about and the reason why this people ask these questions is because they want to – they get tired of the frustration of losing. And so to that, I would reiterate a point I already made, which is one, be patient, and two, understand that you are going to get better and there are lots of supports in place. And there's tons of resources at your disposal. So, you know, I hear a lot from people who – get to a certain cycle. I think especially the Ringmaker cycle was pretty, I think we lost a few stragglers when that cycle broke because there were just some.
They're still in the swamp.
Yeah, they're still there. They've given up.
Damn.
They've been eaten by the giant snake.
Ugh, Nollier scared them away.
So anyway, what, you know, people get very frustrated with that. And so benchmarking is important, but so is just keeping at it. And look and finding people who are built better at building decks than you. And there's nothing wrong with that. And again, just to keep going back to what Matthew's saying, find some great people to play with. When we had Matt Newman on, that was one of his, we were talking about like burnout and things like that. And one of his big tips was just find a great group of people to play with because there are no trophies, but there are warm fuzzies. And if you find a good batch of people to play with, perhaps over some beverages, then that's when the real enjoyment of these types of games come out. And then you can spend some time talking about why this particular part of your deck didn't work or which card needs to go in there and so on and so forth.
And if you're playing solo, make sure you like yourself.
So. Yeah. Self high five.
No, but I know a lot of people say they don't have anyone to play with, which is true, but in this modern age, we do have Octagon, and you can hop on the Discord channel that Carbo the Rings runs to set up games, and mm-hmm. all that helps. One thing that Matthew mentioned that got me thinking is one more use for testing is to test out not decks necessarily, but new cards to see whether they're good or not, so you know whether to use them later on. I've been wrong about plenty of cards just looking at them. I'll ignore that. I can think of the Curious Brandy Buck, which I panned, and I ended up liking it, which I played
I like
it. Palantir, I ended up warming to once I actually used it. So quite a few cards are like that you can only really tell their value by playing them. So that's another case where maybe you want to test out that specific card against multiple quests to see whether, oh, that card seemed good because I used it against Passage Through Mirkwood, or is it because you used it against a bunch of different quests and it always mm-hmm. ended up being useful. So
I have a new card that I want to use is exactly what you're talking about, Ian, which is, you know, you look at it and you think one thing and then you play it. And this is one that I liked it when I looked at it, and having played it, it's even better. Is Heed the Dream out of the latest pack is honestly one of the best cards in that pack. It is so freaking good. And for anyone that's struggling to have their deck kind of come together, you know, because as Matthew mentioned at the top, most decks have key cards that you really need, and you especially might need them, you know, early on to get the deck rolling. And having, you know, being able to spend one lore resource to look at the top five cards of your deck for any one card and add it to your hand is really freaking good. Yeah, and then if your deck happens to have any leadership in it, or you happen to play with people that aren't, again, don't play with jerks, and they might have steward with some extra leadership resources, being able to spend one lore and three leadership resources to go through your entire deck for any card you want and add it to your hand is amazing.
Bananas.
So that card is fantastic, and that's an example of one, for me anyway, where I looked at it and I was like, oh, that looks really good, and then I tried it in a deck, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's going to replace Daron's Runes in like half my decks, because it's just so freaking good to go top five, you know?
I feel like I may be endangering my friendship with Matthew, but I'm really coming around on lore. I want to play more lore decks, and it's because of cards like that that just let you do really cool stuff.
Well, yeah, if you want training wheels, you know, then sure, go fetch the one card you need.
I feel like,
but you know, I think I even said last episode, to be fair, that the designers are doing their damnedest to make me want to build lore decks. And look, it's not that I hate the sphere in general. Yeah, this is a beef I got really quickly, and I'll get over it. But someone said about the relaunch of the progression series, well, can Matthew even talk about things that aren't tactics? Those are fighting words. Because I say nice things about all sorts of cards. I got a current deck. It's Spirit and Leadership, and I've been playing it for months. I haven't touched Tactics in I don't know how long. I can play other spheres. I will say that I think my view of lore is very much hampered by the early life of the game, when I just didn't care for it because it was so dang expensive and not that fun. But I would say the past year or so has given lore many more interesting things to do. And I should probably get over my initial impression that it's sorely out of date and give it a whirl. But sure, I think that's a great card. And there's a lot of lore stuff coming out over this cycle that I'm really excited to give a whirl.
You heard it here first, folks.
Or you heard it in episode 40, but I repeated it in episode 41.
You heard it here for the second time. All right, well, blah, blah, bleep, blah, bloop. Words coming out of my mouth. If you are interested in improving or learning more about cooperative deck building, I do want to recommend a brand new blog that's just come out, I think last week, by a gentleman going by the name of Rob, who comes from Austin, so he may or may not be a Bjorning. And the blog is entirely focused on multiplayer deck building, and he's going to go through fellowships, which are the connected decks, the term that we've been using thanks to RingsDB. And if you want to check that out, it's just getting started. You can get in at the ground level by pointing your browser to averygoodtale.wordpress.com. So that's A Very Good Tale is the new multiplayer blog. Rob's got a blog. We need to sample those and just inject them like into every single episode. Dan's got a blog.
No, we don't.
It just never gets old, Dan. It never gets old.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't said it in a long time, you know, so it's due for a recurrence.
Yeah, well, like all things with the internet is involved, it's become a meme that other people will now say. So thanks for that, Matthew.
You know, I've never thought of turning it into a meme, but my God, is that gold.
That's why Dan's not coming to Gen Con. He's just so sick of that. He can't take it anymore, you guys. I'm just kidding. That's not the reason.
He's got a blog to maintain. He can't make it to Gen Con.
He's too busy blogging.
So I hear.
Sorry, Dan. We love you, and we love your blog. All right.
Wait,
anything else?
A blog?
Anything else about benchmarking or life in general before we wrap this one up?
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Don't open up that can of worms.
Ain't nobody got time for that. We were talking about George R. R. Martin in a Game of Thrones pre-show. Maybe we should get into that. Just kidding. Just kidding. All right. Let's.
Spoiler alert: everyone dies.
Except the people you want to.
that really is the theme of that show. Oh, do you like this person? They're dead. Do you can't stand that one? Yeah, they're going to live the whole way through.
I'm not saying all men must die, but all men must die. This has been episode 41 of the Great Company Podcast, brought to you by our wonderful patrons. If you like what we do on the show and you'd like to support our contests, hosting fees, and so on, please head to patreon.com/grayco to sign up. Extra super special thank you to Christian, our latest to join the Hobbitry in Arms. And as a thank you to our patrons, we are going to do another giveaway. So if you are a part of the patron horde on June 10th, you are automatically enrolled in a drawing for last year's fellowship event kit. We have the playmat that has that kind of Helm's Deep scene with Legolas and Gimli, whatever that guy's name is. And we have the quest Murder at the Prancing Pony. So all you need to do to be entered is to be a patron, and we will do the drawing before our next recording, but we're making the deadline June 10th, and we'll put that up on our various social media outlets as well. Speaking of which, you can get in touch with us through our website at greycompanypodcast.com, and from there we have links to all of our various social media ings, including Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, and so on. If you would like to contact us by email, please do so at thegraycompanypodcast@gmail.com. We would love to read your questions and converse with you and perhaps read your comments on the air as well.
If you're lucky, we'll eyeball your deck.
We will eyeball your
deck.
And
that's not dirty, I promise.
A small fee, a very nominal fee. Just clock in at that like $20 an episode patron level, and we will be happy to eyeball one deck of yours. You can also, I've been popping into that Discord chat a lot recently as well, so there's always good conversation happening and plenty of people who want to talk about cards. So if you haven't yet, that link is, I believe, on the Cardboard of the Rings website. Short of that, thank you so much for listening, and until next time, farewell.